morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about the crucial political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the challenges facing everyone. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here. We're going to be talking about reducing drug prices today. We have the solution, Michael.
We got it, baby. We got the answer to high drug prices, high prescription costs, right here on Denver. God, I feel like we're hawking.
We have the solution.
Yeah, we got.
But
Dave,
we also have a couple of guests in the studio.
That's right.
And someone who actually knows what he's talking about, Mike.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
Dave Brushwood, professor of pharmacology. Consultant to the industries of the world.
There you go.
And a longtime Democratic Perspective guest. We've had him come on twice before talking about drug prices and drug policy.
Because I think it just shows how complex it is. You know, I mean, the fact, it really is.
Yeah,
and 45 minutes, we think we got a long show, but 45 minutes is barely scratching the surface.
We think we have a 45-minute show where Dave is going to be able to talk about this in detail. Mm. But it is such a complex issue, as Mike points out. And it's so important, particularly, I think, to seniors or anybody who gets into a medical emergency, the pricing of drugs, the way that they're researched. And so, Dave, we have Dave and we have Klaus Van Studerheim. Hi, Klaus.
Hey, morning.
And so, where do we want to start, Dave?
Well, why don't we finish up what I started with about 6 or 7 months ago, which is this optimistic idea I had that one of Bernie Sanders' proposals might actually be operationalized in the United States.
It's since been adopted by the Republican Congress and Donald Trump.
Well, yeah, I mean, they've co-opted it. I mean, the idea is, and this is a very good idea, that the United States of America could take the patent from pharmaceutical manufacturers who are overcharging for their product, sort of an eminent domain type action. The government can take property as long as they provide reasonable and entire compensation to the property owner. That's never going to happen. I mean, it's an interesting idea. It's literally an academic idea. It's a democratic perspective, but it's not one that is going necessarily to work.
So what this means, Dave, is if somebody is charging outrageous prices for a drug, way beyond their costs, way beyond a legitimate price, legally the government has the right to take that away from them, compensate them based not on what they're charging, but based on their expenses and a decent profit.
That's exactly right. That legislation exists.
And it's already in the drug code, right?
It's already, yes, it's in the patent laws. It already is there. It's just the will to exercise it that doesn't exist, and I don't think will for many, many, many
Why
years.
Not?
Well, it's just politically not something that anyone wants to do because
the pharmaceutical people don't get people elected.
Exactly.
Pharmaceutical companies get people elected by paying, giving them lots and lots of money. And this is, I mean, this level of corruption, you know, in a banana republic would be shocking. But this is the United States we're talking about. And people just go about their business. Corruption is the.
So the whole sector, the drug sector, has kind of gotten out of control. There's some regulation, but the pricing and of course, you folks all know the joke of getting your drugs from Canada and from Mexico and going to Europe and finding everything costs about a third or a fourth what it does here.
It's not a joke.
So, what can we do? I mean, if the drug, I hear it's one of the most profitable, if not the most profitable industries in the United States. They spend hundreds of millions of dollars on presenting their point of view.
Yep.
And explaining everything in great detail. And also hundreds of millions of dollars on advertising drugs directly to consumers, something allowed in only, I think, what, here in Uganda or something.
I mean, it's New Zealand.
New Zealand. Yeah.
Well, we have a capitalist democracy here in the United States of America, and people are allowed, in fact encouraged, to use the capital that they have to take advantage of opportunities, business opportunities. I think it's important for us to recognize these businesses are creating some very valuable molecules and products that relieve human suffering, that keep people alive, that save lives. The question is, should they be charging as much money as they are, to the extent that some people can afford them and others cannot, and they suffer and they die? And I think most of us, with a democratic perspective, would say, no, that's not right. Let's do something about that. At the federal level, United States Congress, I don't see a solution right now.
All right, Dave, you just said that we have a solution in the patent laws now, and we're not going to do it for political reasons. How else can we lower drug prices?
Okay, well, I have some ideas that I hope don't glaze people's eyes over as they listen to them. There are some things that can be done, and the first approach I call regulatory restraint. Never let a anti-regulatory president go to waste, one might say. We have a president who thinks regulations are bad, that activities of regulatory agencies like the EPA and the National Park Service don't warrant support financially. The FDA, an agency that I respect a great deal, and from my Democratic perspective, I usually encourage to be very involved in industry oversight, sometimes steps too far. So I'm going to suggest several things that we, the people, could ask our representatives in Washington to whisper in the ear of the FDA and ask them to back off of. Now, compounding is one of them. I think everybody remembers the NECC, New England Compounding Center tragedy.
No, we don't.
Okay, well, there was a pharmacy in Massachusetts that manufactured what should have been sterile products that were in fact contaminated with fungi. And they were distributed around the United States. Between 50 and 100 people were killed by these pharmacists as a result of that unlawful act. I beg your pardon?
When was that?
Oh, this would have been, it was just last year that the pharmacist was, Barry Cadden was his name. He was convicted. So this would have been about 2013, 2014.
And this was a compounding?
Compounding pharmacy.
So explain what compounding is.
Compounding means that the pharmacist mixes something together pursuant to the order of a physician rather than the pharmacist simply pulling from the shelf something that has been received by the pharmacist from the manufacturer and is repackaged or relabeled by the pharmacist, but not changed in any way. Compounding means
the big bottle put in the small bottle charges $600.
That's it.
Got it.
That's it. That is dispensing. Compounding means you actually create a product pursuant to a physician's order, oftentimes because it's not available, or perhaps the manufactured product is too expensive. For example, you remember Daraprim. This is the company, the drug that was purchased by a company that Martin Shkreli bought.
One of our favorite
people. He's an easy whipping boy, but I mean, it is a good example.
We don't whip him once he goes to jail.
Well, no, that's a good place for him. Well, maybe others whip him in jail. That drug cost $13.50 when Shkreli purchased it, and he increased the price to $700 per tablet. Pharmacists then said, and have said, and are doing, compounding of it for a dollar a tablet. So pharmacists can decrease the cost through compounding, through extemporaneous compounding. The problem is, as a result of the New England Compounding Center tragedy, where patients died, the Congress gave to the FDA greater power over pharmacists, greater control over pharmacist compounding. And basically, the law says, and the way the FDA is enforcing it, you can't, as a pharmacist, compound a product that is essentially identical to a commercially available product.
Oh.
So if it's commercially available, you have to dispense the commercially available product.
So I can charge anything I want for this commercially, whatever the market will bear, and you can't compound it as a way of competing.
Well, the discussion is, what is commercially available? If it is available, but you can't buy it because you don't have enough money to buy it because it's been priced so high that it's impossible for you to buy, is it commercially available? And pharmacists have said they have priced themselves out of the commercial market. I should be able to compound this and save people huge amounts of money because, in fact, although it's available, it's not commercially available due to its price. Now, what Congress could say to the FDA is back off. In fact, they have. Congress said in the May 2017 budget bill that included funds for the FDA, they said, FDA, we want you to back off this a little bit, if you would, please. And then there were some comments from people at the FDA who said basically something like, we don't really think they mean that. We're going to go ahead and interpret the law the way we think it's meant to be interpreted. A lot of the law is interpretation, obviously. It's not you look at the law and want
to
know.
This is something that has to be changed legislatively or not, or is it just a regulatory decision?
Oh, no. It's FDA's interpretation of the law rather than the commercially available thing. Let's decide what commercially available means. And if FDA decides too expensive for anybody to buy it equals not commercially available, then pharmacists can compound it. But they would have to make that decision.
Let me ask about one of your ideas about marketing unapproved drugs, but some well-known drugs that are effective. But they're not. How does this lower costs?
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Mike. This is something I have trouble explaining sometimes. I'll do the best I can.
All right.
There are on the market today drugs that have not been approved by the FDA. They're called marketed unapproved drugs. Phenobarbital is an example. Immediate release morphine. Meaning.
Why wouldn't they approve their study these? I mean,
they've been around for many, many years. And what the law says, and that's an excellent question, what the law says is that all new drugs must be approved by the FDA. A new drug is a drug that is not generally recognized as safe and effective. So if you have a drug that is generally recognized as safe and effective, for example, phenobarbital for seizure disorders, it's been used for decades, if not centuries. Mm-hmm. You have a drug like morphine for acute pain. You have sublingual nitroglycerin for angina. These are drugs that have been around for many, many years. They are generally recognized as safe and effective. And for many years, the FDA adopted a hands-off approach and said, okay, we're going to require new drugs that aren't generally recognized as safe and effective within the healthcare medical community. We're going to require that they be approved. But we're not going to require that these other generally recognized as safe and effective, not new drugs, be approved. Then there was a tragedy. You see an evolving pattern here.
I do see the pattern. I mean, that the compounding error was in a couple of hundred people dying.
Yeah.
It's like a big deal. And so these are all overreactions to legitimate disasters then.
Well, this is what regulatory agencies do. They look for an opportunity to regulate. That's what, and to quote, never let a good disaster go to waste. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is Rahm Emanuel who says, let's figure out a way to use this productively. So FDA, unfortunately, there was another incident in the 90s, late 90s, early 2000s, a drug, Eferol IV, and it's a vitamin E injectable, intravenous vitamin E product that some criminals put on the market, and it killed neonates, little babies, very sympathetic victims. As a result of, and they had not, and their argument was, gee whiz, these laws are so complicated, we misunderstood. We thought this was generally recognized as safe and effective, therefore it was legal for us to put it on the market. It stayed on the market for 5 months. Finally, FDA figured out what was happening, and they filed an injunction, and the perpetrators went to prison, which is where they belong. But we still have between 50 and 100 babies who are dead. And FDA said, we just can't risk this anymore. We can't risk any drugs being unapproved. We're going to require that they all, we'll clarify everything. We'll clarify that these new drugs, that all drugs are new drugs and need to be approved.
And that adds to the cost.
They don't really have the manpower to do this efficiently and time sensitively, right?
Well, they don't. What most of these drugs that are really not new, because they are generally recognized as safe and effective, can be approved based on existing data. there are existing studies. You don't have to go out and do clinical trials. In order to provide an incentive to a company to do, why would a company do that? In order to provide an incentive, there is a non-patent period of exclusivity that's given to the first to gain approval. There is a period of time where there's relaxed enforcement and the other companies can exhaust their supply. But basically, you result in one company having a non-patent monopoly, and the other companies just say, well, we could go do what they have done, but we're not making any money off of this. These are low-cost drugs. We have other opportunities to use our capital in other ways. So they leave the market. And an example of that is colchicine. The cost went from 9 cents per tablet to $4.85 per tablet after the FDA approved the first colchicine product. It had not needed to be approved because it's generally recognized as colchicine's for gout. I mean, it's been used for hundreds of years. Now FDA says, well, we're going to require you to approve it. And I think in a deregulatory or anti-regulatory climate, what we might do is say to FDA, slow down on this. Actually, FDA has surveillance programs. They have active and passive surveillance where they're looking at medication use. They're looking for markers of harm caused by drugs. They're looking for evidence that products used by the American people are causing harm to them. And certainly if they were to see evidence that colchicine is causing harm, step in and do something.
But without that evidence,
this is reported by the doctors. I mean, you report, or it's a statistical thing.
Well, that's a really interesting question. It turns out that reporters to the FDA in a program called MedWatch are most frequently pharmacists. And I'm proud of that. Obviously, I should be, being a pharmacist myself. So I investigated that, or shouldn't claim it. I had a student who investigated why it is that the reporter of adverse drug events tends most frequently to be the pharmacist. And it's because the doctor detects it. And the doctor says, well, I don't have time to report this. This is burdensome. There's a lot of paperwork involved. Pharmacist, you do it. And the pharmacist does it, not because the pharmacist has been so astute and recognized it, but because the pharmacist is essentially the scribe.
But they get plenty of information from things, I believe, anyway, like the Veterans Administration, places where they can, those doctors and those organizations, those units, have to report stuff. And so I think it seems like the FDA has a pretty good handle on where it's going bad. Between the FDA and the CDC, anyway, we can see, you know, that not a great deal of bad drugs are getting, or any bad drugs are getting into the USA system. So you're saying less regulation, at least where the FDA has gone overboard, would probably, and certainly in the examples that you provided, would these commonly used drugs that have 10, 20, 30 times the cost before regulation. So that's, I have to admit, even though this is Democratic perspective, that's a good anti-regulatory argument. One of the things I want to make sure we get in today, and we can talk about, you got some other great ideas here, but I do want to talk about prescription assistant programs. I had a request from a listener. Who decides, and what we're talking about, and I just saw it yesterday, some guy's going to get this free drug for a year, some guy without any money, some person without any money, is going to get this life-saving drug. Somehow he got himself into the headlines as needing the drug, and the pharmaceutical company stepped up, and we see this happen several times a year, and they say, okay, well, we're going to give him the drug. But anybody that kind of thinks to the next level knows there's probably thousands of people out there who aren't the drug. The pharmaceutical company is not giving the drug for free. How do you get, and then before the we went on the air, you talked, well, these are called prescription assistant programs. How do you get that?
Okay. They are systematic but non-systematic as well, okay, in the sense that there is a way to do it, but it's so burdensome to qualify for these programs that most people who need the drugs because they're poor and they can't otherwise get them aren't well enough organized in their lives that they can go through the process of qualifying to receive them.
Or just well enough.
Well, that could be also.
Yeah.
So these are prescription assistance programs. They started up in the early 1990s. I think there's a lot of public relations value in them. The idea is that drug companies give their product away for free. We don't believe that, do we? Are they giving their drug away for free, or are they instead charging a little bit more of the people who can actually pay for them in order to cover the cost of the free? They're not free. Nothing is free. These are not philanthropies, and we shouldn't expect them to be. At any rate, through these pharmaceutical assistance programs, prescription assistance programs, patient assistance programs, depends on what you call it. PAP is the acronym. The basic idea is if you have limited financial resources and a drug you need is not covered by some plan that you have, insurance or Medicare Part D or Medicaid, it's usually not Medicaid because Medicaid's pretty all-encompassing, then you can apply. What you have to do is submit an application. There has to be some sort of needs assessment done by a doctor, the doctor who says the patient really needs this drug, rather than the patient's trying to acquire it for someone else who needs it, and this person doesn't really need it. So there has to be a needs assessment, and then there has to be a financial qualification. I mean, this is the sort of thing social workers do.
Right.
And it is logistically challenging. You can do it online, but you have to have a computer to do it online. You have to have a scanner. You have to be so well enough organized that you can provide evidence of your income, which a lot of people who are poor and don't have money and don't have insurance don't have. They just don't have the organization in their lives to be able to do this.
Well, like you just said, though, and I think you hit the nail on the head, and that is right now, social workers, if your unit, hospital unit, or whatever you're in, whatever, or your doctor's office or your medical center is lucky enough to have a few social workers, then they become experts at working these physicians, these drug assistants.
Certainly one that I found with my father when he was ill, one of the most useful persons in the hospital was the social worker.
Yeah.
It really solved a lot of the problems and worked with him constantly. So, but is there that support? So what you're saying is that there's this big publicity campaign about these free drugs, but the actual process is far from being what it sounds like it is.
Well, the good news is NGOs, non-government organizations, have stepped in to fill the void. And it's taken a while for that to happen. I usually don't mention names, but I admire these people so much. There's one called RX Assist. It's online. And you can go to the RX Assist website and tell them, here's the drug I need, and they will provide specific instructions on what you need to do to get the drug that you need, if you qualify for it. And they will help you determine whether or not you qualify. My wife and I were on the board of directors of a nonprofit in Gainesville, Florida, where we used to live, and we had a social worker. Actually, we were in a university town, so we had social work students, and they would qualify people. They would do the paperwork. Now, just the logistics, though, are difficult, particularly for that organization my wife and I were with. What happens is once you qualify, which is burdensome, then you have the drugs sent to your home. Well, you must have a home to have them sent to for you to receive them. They won't send them to, these are drugs. These are pharmaceutical products. They will send them either to the doctor or to the pharmacy or to your home. Well, if you ask one of these folks, pretty down and out folks, who is your doctor? Well, they don't have a doctor.
Right.
Who is your pharmacy? Well, we don't have a pharmacy. We're just getting by day to day. So,
not having a doctor is far more common, I think, than people realize, particularly with people without a lot of funds. They don't have doctors. They go to the emergency room for a crisis. I mean, I saw this constantly when we lived in New York. And they don't have doctors. They don't have connections. They don't have a lot of information about medicine in general, about pharmacy.
Oh, that's absolutely right. But the NGOs have tried to help. Some NGOs have physical locations within communities, and our NGO said, why don't you send the drugs to us and we will distribute them to the, well, we don't have a pharmacy license. I mean, you can't, these are pharmaceutical products. They're very dangerous if they're misused or used by people who shouldn't have them. So there are a lot of, you know, Mike's question is excellent about these PAPs. They exist. They sound great. The publicity, I would suspect, is if you were to wonder, who was behind this press release about this person in Los Angeles who benefited from this pharmaceutical assistance program, it could very well be the PR firm for the pharmaceutical manufacturer who wanted everyone to know of the wonderful things that they were doing.
Sure. If you're the PR guy for a pharmaceutical company, and some pharmaceutical companies are not very popular because the word about the price gouging and stuff has sort of gotten around, then this is a great way just to sell your product, soften the anger at pharmaceuticals, and reduce the questioning of pharmaceutical prices in general, right? Well, you can get this drug for free if you qualify. Well, otherwise, you got to pay.
And that's exactly what I want to address the expert here. Dave, we're talking to Dave Brushwood here, pharmaceutical professor and all-around drug expert on the good side. Okay, that seems like the prescription assistant programs, these PAPs, most drug companies have them, yes? How can we put pressure on to have more of them, to broaden them? You talked about your NGOs and the social workers having the expertise to navigate some of these more difficult. So, that's the heart of the question. Who decides? Who gets the drugs and who doesn't? And you're saying, well, it's simply application and it's need and income. Well, the income question becomes, you know, I'm not a wealthy guy, and then there's lots of drugs out there that would make me broke. But I feel like I deserve a prescription assistant program. But I'm not living on the street.
Well, this is something that I think the pharmacy profession could embrace and has not as it could. That there are, I say that with some qualifiers. Chris and I are an acquaintance, friend of mine, an acquaintance of hers, who is a pharmacist and sued his employer False Claims Act case. I mean, that gets complicated. But the bottom line is, if you are a citizen of the United States and you see somebody who is cheating the United States, you can go to the United States of America and say, I'm a whistleblower, my employer is cheating the United States, and you can recover some of that. You can personally receive some of the funds they recover from the cheater. And this friend of ours did that, received about $10 million. And what he decided is he was going to, and has established a pharmacy in Tampa. And the idea is everybody who needs drugs and can't get them otherwise comes to me. He will use the PAPs. I mean, his $10 million sounds like a lot of money, but it's going to run out fairly quickly.
So we're talking about buying pharmaceuticals.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. And he doesn't like to buy them unless he has to.
Sure.
So what he does is he hires a social worker, and she qualifies people to receive these. Because it's a licensed pharmacy, the drug companies can send the drugs to him.
Uh-huh.
I think there are a lot of people. This is a model that I should have done a better job of explaining to other pharmacists who I think are very kind-hearted and would do the same thing, particularly retired pharmacists, if they had the opportunity. It's just something that's not organized. Now, when we have something good that needs to be done for everyone, for the people of the United States of America, who is it that usually steps in and organizes the effort? Well, it's the government that usually does that. But that's a Democratic perspective. And Democratic perspectives are not in full favor right now. So it's up to NGOs to non-systematically, in a disorganized way, step up and do what they can.
But this means, Dave, that if you're in a place that has one of these pharmacies and you don't have any money and you need a drug that's very expensive, you're in good shape because you have a social worker. They'll help you get them and there'll be a place. But if you don't live in one of those communities and it's much more difficult, you go online and so forth and so on. Are we using our retired pharmacists as well as we could? Is there any kind of retired pharmacist organization where these older pharmacists could begin to fill in some of these gaps where it's become so expensive?
Well, yeah, you're looking at one of them who's not doing that. I'm 69 years old. I'm a retired pharmacist, and I could certainly be doing what it is that I'm describing others are doing, but I am not. I don't know of any organized way.
No, but you're researching and you're talking to us,
well,
and you're doing a great deal of good, David.
Before,
but maybe there is something that it can. Obviously, can't do that here, right, Mike? But I mean, just thinking that maybe we're not using a resource that we could use. The other thing is that, maybe it's a good thing. Pharmacists in the United States don't always have the amount of authority that they do, say, in Europe. In Europe, the doctor writes a prescription for a drug. You go to the pharmacy, at least in Spain, and the pharmacist decides what the dosage is and how long you take it. And you have a long talk with them, and they tell you what's going on. It's a very different system. Is our system, you think, a pretty good one that we have here?
No. But I think we're getting better. And I want to talk about a piece of legislation that probably will pass in 2018 in Florida in the next legislative session, which will begin in late February. The proposal that seems to have support from everyone who matters is that pharmacists be given authority to diagnose influenza and streptococcal pharyngitis in the pharmacy.
Right.
And they specify you have to be specially trained to do it, have to be in a collaborative practice with a physician who actually authorizes the medication. But if you feel you have flu or feel you have a severe sore throat that might be strep throat, then you go to a pharmacy. And it's just a very simple test. It's either a nasal swab or a throat swab that within 15 minutes is either positive or negative for flu or strep. At that point, very quickly, the pharmacist, well, not very quickly necessarily, depends on what the queue looks like, but the pharmacist is able to authorize Tamiflu or erythromycin or whatever it is that the pharmacist deems is appropriate, pursuant to the protocol established with the physician. Huge cost saving. So it's not just the product. It's the way of acquiring the product that's so costly as well. If you have the flu and you need Tamiflu, I don't think my wife would mind my saying she had about a flu recently. She went into urgent care here. It cost her $180 to have somebody do this nasal swab and say, yep, it's the flu, and give her a prescription that she then had to take to the pharmacy and wait in line at the pharmacy. It doesn't need to be that way. So Steve's idea, Klaus may have some ideas about this, the European approach too, and how pharmacies can, but yeah, pharmacists can be better used and reduce drug costs in that way.
Yeah, well, let me ask you a question that has puzzled me for a long time, which is that in all developed countries, the basic health of the population is better than the U.S., although the U.S. spends a lot more money per patient or per population than other Western developed countries. Why is that? With all the money we spend, why aren't we healthier than the rest of the world?
Well, we have a diverse population, and that's one answer. We don't take care of our people the way we should, and we spend our money in inappropriate ways. I once saw a statistic. This may be about 10 years old. 50% of our healthcare expenditures occur during the last 6 months of a patient's life.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
I heard 90%, but
some other cultures, this is a rough thing for me to say. Some other cultures are better than ours at knowing when to let go, at managing futility well, at knowing I really have a responsibility as a citizen of this country not to overuse resources that aren't going to benefit me in any particular way. So I think, I know this to be the case in the UK because I have a friend who's done work at Oxford, and she has told me that that is the case. It's not so much what government says they will spend. It's just the cultural recognition that at the end of life, quality is more important to me than quantity, and we haven't really come to that point here.
And
we're
spending
fortunes, right? Sorry, Mike. We're spending fortunes to keep people alive a couple of extra weeks or so.
Or hours. Yeah.
Well, that's it. I was just going to.
Is that the main reason, really?
Well, I mean, that's 50% or so. Mike says he saw 90%. Yeah, that would be another reason, of course, is that you have monopsony power, bargaining power in countries that have single payers. It's not, right. We talk about, well, why doesn't the government in the United States set prices, reduce prices that can be charged? Well, because the government isn't paying. I mean, they do at the VA. They do in some government programs. But when you have a single payer in pharmaceuticals, for example, that's what I really know the best.
Go ahead.
Well, in single, you have a class of drugs, blood pressure medicines, and maybe there are 12 different manufacturers of them, and they're essentially the same. And the single payer says, here's what we're going to pay for blood pressure medication. You guys need to decide whether you're in or out. And two or three of the 12 are going to say, well, we're in, even though the others decide they're out. We just don't have that bargaining power here in the United States because we don't have the monopsony, the single payer.
Let's talk about, before we run out of time, I want to talk about the gag rule.
Okay.
You know, since we're on this subject, what am I talking about?
Okay, what you're talking about is, and this I only came to realize about a year ago, prescription benefit management programs, companies, PBMs, negotiate prices of pharmaceuticals, and they enter into contracts with pharmacies. So you really have two elements of the pharmacy profession. There are the people who provide the products and services to people who need them, and then there are other people who negotiate the price with the manufacturers. And they actually do have some bargaining power, but they enter into a variety of agreements that aren't necessarily for the benefit of the public, but are for the benefit of them financially. This means sometimes when a patient goes to a pharmacy, the price that they pay through their insurance plan is higher than the price they would pay if they paid outside the plan with cash. Recognizing this, some of the companies in the contract with the pharmacy say, you are pharmacist, Mr. Pharmacist, Dr. Pharmacist, beg your pardon, Dr. Pharmacist, you are forbidden to tell a patient who is covered by our plan that if they get their medication outside the plan, they will pay less money in cash than they would going through the plan. State legislatures have discovered this. Connecticut, I think, was the first, and they passed a no-gag rule law saying provisions such as this within a contract between a PBM and a pharmacy are unenforceable.
Allowing the pharmacy to say, hey, you know, if you buy this outside the plan, it costs $3. If you buy it in the plan, it costs $15.
That's right. Now, there are some.
Well, you have to pay your copay anyway.
You have to pay your copay. Well, yes. You have to.
Which is more than the drug price.
Sometimes the copay or the deductible is higher than the cost of the drug if you pay yourself.
Right.
So some pharmacists I've talked to just say, we ignore that. That's unethical. It's immoral. I don't care. Well, I mean, they're making a choice that could expose them to breach of contract with the company. And it's not an easy choice for them to make. They need protection. They need help. They need support. And state legislatures can do that. The federal government, but it's the Democrats who are talking about some sort of, and it probably isn't going to happen on the federal level. The state legislatures can provide that kind of support. I mean, pharmacists are in a bit of a quandary because the state law in most states requires that they dispense a less expensive generic equivalent and pass on the cost savings to the patient. While the contract they have with the PBM may say, well, you can do that, but it violates the contract if you do that. And it's a difficult choice. Do I follow the law or do I follow the contract?
They shouldn't be put in that position.
They shouldn't.
They absolutely shouldn't.
So what does the consumer do if I have to take a lot of medicine? So I walk into the pharmacy and I say, hey, would this be cheaper if I bought it directly?
Yes. Yeah, you should ask that. And, I get my medicine. I don't get much, but I get my medicine at Bash's here. Just tip of the hat to Bash's. They have told me that the medication I receive would be cheaper to me off plan. So I pay cash. Well, I use a credit card, but I mean, I don't use my plan.
Close enough.
Because the pharmacist at Bash's has told me that.
But if they hadn't told you that, you wouldn't know. And how many people are going to go through and ask that about all their different meds and stuff?
Well, you should be told. I mean, I did not have to ask. This Bash's pharmacist told me that we can give this to you off plan and it costs less. It's levothyroxine sodium. I mean, it's for hypothyroid. Yeah. I mean, it's cheap stuff. So drugs like that are inexpensive, you're better off not getting through your insurance plan.
I am getting it through my insurance plan, Dave.
So. Yeah.
You learned something this morning. No, I'm the same way. My copay with the VA, I have to pay a copay with the VA, is more than one particular drug that I take that I bought. But I found that out by accident because I was getting it from a non-VA doctor. I said, and paying cash for it. And then I got through the VA and I said, whoa, wait a minute. My copay is more than it costs me when I just go to the pharmacy and pay cash. So it was just, like I said.
I think most people really don't know that. I think most people don't know that.
I don't think it's all that common.
I don't think so either, but people shouldn't have to know that. There are certain responsibilities that professions have in order to provide the safest and effective and most efficient, least costly medication. And pharmacies should be in a position where they're not looking at a contract thinking, oh boy, I can get in trouble if I do the right thing.
I took a medicine when I had, and I've talked to you about this, but I think it's pretty typical. I took a medicine years ago for my back. It was very effective for a few years. After a while, I had to have back operations and so forth and so on. They switched me from a generic, an inexpensive generic, to this, to Lyrica. It's a to Lyrica, which I had taken years ago to see if it would be more effective than the generic. The drug was approved in 2009, in other words, by the FDA. So it's been on the market for years and years and years, and yet I found the price had maybe doubled, maybe tripled when I took it a few years ago. I guess my final question to you is, what's causing the drug pricing that we see? Is it advertising? Is it getting profit? Or is it actual research-based?
Oh, it's what the market will bear. It's what insurance companies, what people are willing to pay. And what you could do under a circumstance like that is go back to your doctor and say, could we retry the generic and see if this will work a little bit better? But it's what the market will bear.
Well, listen, before I run out of time, I want to certainly thank Dave Brushwood, a pharmaceutical expert, and we may have time, but we want to say hello to Democrats of the Red Rocks and thank them for their support of Democratic Perspective, their ongoing support.
Annual meeting, Mike, is January 28th, and they have a really good speaker program. Terry Goddard is coming to speak.
I heard Terry Goddard's coming, yeah.
And
some candidates.
Wade Carlisle, who's running for the state senate.
Some candidate, yeah.
And Bobby Tyler.
Yeah. So the 28th?
Yeah, this Sunday, food, I think it starts at 4:30 to set up.
Go to the website, get the details from Democrats of Red Rocks on their annual meeting. Lots of good food, as usual. Yep, good stuff. We want to give a shout-out to Steve Segner and his crew over at El Portal. And we want to mention the Women's March here at the end of the show. We wanted the 600 or so. I was marching in the cold and the rain with
It rained
folks.
And snowed for the exact 2 hours of the march. And it stopped.
Exactly correct. So I marched for an hour in the rain and snow, and I drank wine for the other hour just to let you know. So I suffered on a variety of levels. Don't forget, VVID.org has this podcast and all our shows on VVID.org. Please listen to our podcasts.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and our nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 a.m. news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.